It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. First, do you ever have brilliant ideas in the shower or solve a problem while you're taking a walk or doing the dishes? Research actually backs up this phenomenon of common tasks boosting our creativity. It's sometimes called the shower effect. You know, when Archimedes had that eureka moment in the bathtub and discovered the principle of buoyancy, he's probably benefiting from the shower effect, or in his case, the bathtub effect. We're taking a look at the science behind those shower moments, how we can use them to be more creative. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. When do you have your best ideas? Have you had this kind of moment? You're beating your head against a wall trying to solve a problem at work, around the house, and then you step away from it and do something different, and then the answer comes to you? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Richard Sema is the Brain Matters columnist at the Washington Post's Well-Being Desk, covering the neuroscience of everyday life. He was a neuroscience researcher for years before becoming a journalist. Richard, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Rob.
Before we dig into the research, and there is research on this, you write, let's talk about creativity a bit. People might think creativity, that's, you know, writing a song, writing a book, painting a picture, whatever. Creativity pops up a lot in our lives, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's anything that gets you out of your normal everyday thinking about both what you're working on, but also like how you enjoy yourselves. Like, I always think of like when I was a kid and just being outside playing with sticks and having imaginary sword fights. And, you know, like you could apply creative thinking to how you have fun, as well as like how you plan social events. Also, if you have something to like problem solve at work, it's good to think outside the box.
And I do this sometimes, you know, I'm staring at a screen trying to write a, say, a radio script or something like that. And I stare and stare and get nothing done. And then I just walk around the halls for a few minutes and then it sorts itself out and I can go back and start writing. Do you have things like that in your own life?
Oh, definitely. I definitely take advantage of long showers when I'm also writing and not really sure how to explain something, and just sitting in the shower, it seems to just percolate up while I'm like washing my hair or something, which is nice. And as you mentioned, there's like research backing this up where they had physicists and writers write down their most creative ideas every day. And it turns out 20% of these thoughts came during showers or while they're doing chores away from their desk. And it's pretty amazing to me. And also the researchers mentioned, like, how many other things can you do as well in the shower or doing chores as you can at work?
And there's research looking at what's going on in our brains, sometimes pretty creative research. What kind of things are out there that have illustrated, you know, how this works?
Yeah, so this shower effect is the product of what psychologists called mind wandering, which is basically when your thoughts are anywhere else besides the task you're currently doing. And so mind wandering could be negative, right? Like you could be like going into rumination or like dark thoughts, but it really depends on what you're thinking about. And there's research showing that if you mind wander about something you're interested in, you can be happier and in some cases more creative. So there is one study that was like, you know, basically looking at what kinds of activities people are doing while they're mind wandering. And there's a sweet spot. It's like if the activity is moderately engaging, people were more likely to have creative outputs for an experiment. Because it seems like if you're doing something that is engaging your attention, giving your mind something to sort of like stimulate it, something to nosh on, that was good for the creative process. But if it was something really boring, then they were completely like off task. They were thinking about other things that didn't really matter, weren't really creative. Right, but if it's also something too engaging, you don't have enough mind space to think about those ideas that you are percolating in the back of your mind.
Right. So staring at a wall isn't going to help. That's too boring. If I'm playing a super intense video game, that's probably occupying, I guess, what, too much of my mind to come up with that creative solution?
Yeah, exactly. You're probably too engaged about, you know, your Mario jump puzzle and not really having much to like think about what you're writing about.
We're talking to Richard Sema with the Washington Post Well-Being Desk, looking at the shower moment, how to harness creativity, our problem-solving skills, by stepping away from the problem itself taking a shower, going for a walk, that some kind of activity can help us percolate, develop our solution, our creativity. Do you have something like this? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. However you use creativity, at home, at work, whatever, are there things that you do to get away from the problem and come up with a solution by doing something else? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi, Rob. Ah, that shower moment, it's all wet.
No, but anyway, seriously, Dennis.
Sometimes what happens is I'll be listening to something, and it connects with what I've been thinking about, whether it's something from the previous day or the current day. Have you ever heard of the Ideas Network of Public Radio?
I have, Dennis. Do you get those serendipity moments where something connects like that?
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. Dennis, thanks a lot. Richard, like, reaching out to some other form, you know, if you're doing computer code, listening to music or something like that, are there ways to maybe get that serendipitous inspiration that Dennis finds?
Yeah, that's an amazing example. And I'm glad that Dennis called in about that because, yeah, it's like these moments allow you to have more stimulation that you wouldn't otherwise probably get if you're just sitting at your desk. Going back to that first study, looking at the physicists and the writers and the ideas that they had while they're not working, a lot of those ideas were actually more of these aha moments, these eureka breakthroughs on something that they were struggling with. It seems like if you're doing something else, you are going to be in a different mind space. You are going to have different stimulation. So, of course, your mind will produce different thoughts than if you're just in the same exact desk working on the same exact problem in the same exact way.
Dennis, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Okay, there's research you write about from, I think, almost exactly a year ago about what's happening in our brains when we're being creative. And this is a pretty wild study. Can you tell us about this?
Yeah, so basically, you know, researchers have been looking for a while at what happens in the brain when we are both mind-wandering and also when we're doing something creative. So in the brain, there's a network of different brain regions called the default mode network, which is activated when we are thinking inward. You know, we're daydreaming or we're mind-wandering. You know, we're not paying as much attention to the outside world. And there's been a lot of evidence showing that this default mode network in the brain is, you know, really good for creativity. And last year in January, we had the first, you know, experiment that demonstrated if you disrupt this default mode network, you have, you are able to disrupt creativity. So, you know, this group at the University of Utah had patients who were going in for brain surgery because they had tumors, which, you know, it allows for the very rare opportunity to like stimulate their brains, which is part of routine surgery. And they had the patients do what's this classic creativity task called the alternate use task. You give them, you know, a standard item like a brick or a pencil, and you ask how many different ways can you use this in weird, novel like settings. And so, you know, the patients, when they weren't having their default mode network disrupted, they were able to be like, yeah, a tire, you could use it as a cushion, you could use it as a garden fountain, you could cut it up as jewelry. But when they stimulated this default mode network, you know, they asked this one patient, what can you do with a pencil? She struggled. She was like, you could draw with it. You can draw cartoons, mostly draw. And, you know, after they stopped stimulating and like inhibiting the default mode network, she was able to get it back. But it showed that this network seems really important for, you know, this divergent out of the box thinking.
Let's bring on another caller at 800-642-1234. Meg is with us in Hudson. Meg, hello.
Hello. I have to say that when you were talking about being creative in the shower, it's kind of embarrassing to admit, but I was a reporter for 30 years and I did a lot of writing, and that's where I wrote all the best opening graphs and my best columns while I was taking a shower. So being all wet is a good thing.
Now, Meg, you can't write it down while you do it. Were you able to retain after you had that inspiration long enough to get over to the whatever notepad or computer and get it on paper?
Yeah, but that's why I had to retire, because my memory started to go. So,
oh, okay.
But no, I was able to retain it, and I was always amused by the fact that the most responses I got to my columns were usually the ones that were pretty much predominantly written in the shower. So,
No kidding, Meg. Thanks a lot for sharing that. Yeah, Richard, I mean, do you have some advice on how to harness that so people can figure out to do what Meg did?
Yeah, there's some people who recommend getting waterproof notebooks so you could write it down. Because, like, yeah, you know, you're there, you're having the thoughts, and you don't always know when it's going to come up. Might as well have something close at hand. I know there's a story, like, Carl Sagan, a, you know, really prominent science communicator, used to, like, draw on the fog of the shower and maybe write down what, you know, he wrote there afterwards. But, yeah, there's some ways to harness it more directly. But yeah, I haven't taken that extra step. I also have shower thoughts and just scramble to my notepad or my computer afterwards to quickly jot down that great, like, idea or graph before it disappears.
Meg, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Glenn is with us now on the road. Glenn, hi.
Well, hello. How are we doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us about or ask about?
Well, I got to hear part of Meg's comments, which is I just want to reiterate the same thing. Like, I could be laying in bed or I could be taking a walk, nothing. But as soon as I get in the shower, that's where all the ideas come. And I was wondering if there's been a study done about water, because I really do feel like it has something to do with water.
Interesting, Glenn. Is there something about the sound, the feel of water, Richard? I don't know if there's been research on that yet.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything directly that I know of testing, you know, whether it's the sound or the feel or, like, just it being just a pleasant experience for most people, the warmth. There's nothing that I know of, but I think that's a good place to look. One thought is that, you know, it is, you know, providing a very different context. Like, you're usually not wet, you're usually clothed during the day. So you're in a completely different mind state because you are experiencing completely different things than you normally are. So maybe that has something to do with it, but the water angle would be really interesting to look at.
Definitely. Glenn, thanks a lot for the question. We're talking to Richard Sima, Brain Matters columnist at the Washington Post Well-Being Desk, talking to us about the science of creativity, why everyday tasks can help boost it. Things like maybe you have great ideas in the shower or doing the dishes or out for a walk or, well, you tell us. Call 800-642-1234. Where do you go when you need to come up with an idea to solve a problem? Do you just grind it out, keep plugging away at it, or do you need to step away and do something different? What is that something different? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Washington Post columnist Richard Sima about the science of creativity, the research finding that there's a reason you have better ideas in the shower or maybe while doing household chores or walking or a lot of things we could find those creative solutions. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have something like this? Have you had great ideas in the shower, or are there things you do to break up your work day or your creativity where you go away from it, and that's where you get your good ideas? Call 800-642-1234 and tell us about it, or ask your questions about the neuroscience of creativity. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Back to your calls now. Russ is with us on the road. Russ, hi.
Hey, nice to talk to you. Well, I guess I'll throw a little water on the whole deal about showers. I get my best ideas when I wake up in the morning. I kind of linger there laying in bed. It's like my mind has been kind of working on it subconsciously. And so it comes to light. I get up and I go to it.
I get that sometimes too. Now, are you able to do things like you're able to hop out of bed and put it into action, Richard, right away? Because my worry is, again, if I dawdle too long, then I eat breakfast and make the coffee, I forget about it.
I get right to it. I've been inventing novel ways to make third houses specifically for Purple Martins. And so I go right down to my workshop and start putting it into action.
Excellent. Thanks a lot for sharing that with us, Russ. Richard, you had some thoughts.
Yeah, that's really cool, Russ. Actually, that is probably going to be a follow-up piece about how sleeping on it does actually work for creativity, because there is research showing that your mind does work on these open loop questions. Like, you haven't solved something, it's still in your subconscious working on in the background. So if you go to sleep with that question in mind, you might wake up with a solution or something new to play with, you know, when you wake up. And I think a similar maybe piece of advice is like your phone is there if you want to jot it down before you get out of bed, or something to write it down just so you don't, you know, have it dissipate when you wake up fully.
And thanks a lot for sharing that, Russ. I want to contrast that with dreaming, because sometimes I think we wake up and think we had this brilliant ideas in a dream. And then, you know, if we write it down in the morning, it's like ninja penguin tablecloth or something like that, right? Our dreaming isn't really necessarily going to solve our problems.
Yeah, not necessarily. But it's interesting, because I was actually talking with my mother about this, and she brought up, she's a programmer, and she brought up that she could actually do computer coding in her dreams. And I asked her, like, do you actually get to use any of the code? And she's like, yeah, like I solve a lot of problems this way. And wow. I was kind of amazed. So I guess your mileage may vary. I certainly don't have that ability.
Thanks a lot for that call. Bob joins us now in Lake Nabogamon. Sorry, Bob. Thanks a lot for calling in.
Nabogamon.
Thank you. What did you want to tell us
Northern
about?
Northern Wisconsin. I think a lot of this is related to theta wave activity. T-H-E-T-A. It's when you lay in bed in the morning, sometimes when you go to sleep at night, sometimes in the shower, you're really creative. And I think that is what a lot of this is. It's at times when you feel safe and relaxed and you're pondering something in the theta wave activity. It's close to sleep.
Interesting. Bob, I don't know much about theta waves. Do you come across this in your line of work?
I'm a nurse anesthetist, and I've been putting people to sleep and waking them up for 35 years.
Ah.
And some of our medicines will negate theta wave activity. Some of it kind of enhances it. And I've had many, many patients just look at me and go, wow, you know, I know that they were in some theta wave activity because something in their life came fresh to them. You know what I mean?
Interesting, Bob. Thanks for sharing that perspective. Richard, I don't know, is there research out there about the theta waves in the brain? I'm not even sure what they are, and our creativity.
Yeah, so that's a really interesting insight and line of thinking. But basically, it's a type of brainwave activity, and it's the frequency at which, you know, you have these spikes of brain activity. And I believe theta waves are really fast spiking and seems to correlate with when there's a lot of neural activity. You know, when you're sleeping, it's usually slower, except in certain cases, like during REM sleep, where you have a lot of this fast bursting theta waves. And I believe there's some research showing that this type of brain wave activity is really important for processing information, making memories, and, you know, certain types of learning. So I could definitely see that this could be involved with creativity, though I'm currently not sure what the research is on that, but that's my general knowledge, that these different brain waves, theta is really important for this type of thinking.
Thanks a lot for the call, Bob. Mike joins us now in Milwaukee. Mike, hi.
Hi, this is Mike.
Yeah, go ahead. What did you want to tell us about, Mike?
Well, I work in manufacturing. I've done that for decades, and over the years have made the observation that when struggling with a, let's say, equipment problem, something that you just can't get working properly, and I'll break for lunch, and then notice that when I get back from lunch, I can see the issue and clearer, and usually get things resolved. And it's really amazing. It's like, is there a connection? Is it the gut-brain connection, or is it just a distraction of being away from the, you know, the problem, and you're looking away, just like what you're talking about.
Interesting.
But I think that there could be the gut-brain connection there that could be helping out as well.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Richard, what do you think? Is it the eating or the stepping away that's helping Mike solve these problems?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's a gut-brain connection, though. I don't know if that's been looked at, mm-hmm. but I definitely think the stepping away is helpful, because your brain is still working on it even when you're not like explicitly thinking about it. There's some really interesting research from over a century ago by like a Russian psychologist showing that if you give people problems to solve and you interrupt some of the problems, they are more likely to remember the problems that were interrupted than the ones that they actually solved. So it seems like your brain is holding on to those unfinished questions and probably working on it while you're on your lunch break.
Mike, thanks a lot for that call. Richard, in our last minute, it seems like there's a practical takeaway. I think one mode of thinking is when you're in school, you nose to the book, keep plugging away. You're at work, you know, grind for 12 hours a day. It seems like recess and lunch breaks and all those things really are actually going to make us more productive.
Yeah, I definitely think so. I don't always practice it because it feels like, oh, if I just sit there, I will figure it out. But no, I think the research is pretty clear that if you can take a break, you should allow yourself to take that break. You know, it relieves your stress, which puts in, you know, you in a better mental state, but also gives you like a break from a set mode of thinking. And if you get a change of scenery, you might get different stimulation to your brain, which leads to different thoughts, which might lead to a different solution to the problems that you've been having. And one final thing is just, I would encourage people to think about what experiences, what settings seem to really help you personally for being in this creative mode of thinking. You know, all our minds are different. So what gives us that relaxed, you know, mind wandering, mind meandering state is going to be different for you than for someone else. But you have the ability to think about what that is for you and try to use it.
Richard, thanks for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, this was great, Rob. Thank you.
That's Richard Sima, the Brain Matters columnist at the Washington Post Well-Being Desk, covering the science, a neuroscience of everyday life. He talked to us about some of the science behind creativity and these so-called shower moments, when we step away, do something different, and then come up with our creative solutions to problems. Thanks for all your calls. And you can keep sharing those, by the way, if you have something like that, the thing you go and do to help you be creative, to figure out that problem you've been mulling over at work or at home all day. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now think about the saying, find out what you're made of. Usually that's about character, values, toughness, more than, you know, the nuts and bolts of the human body. But what was the last time you actually got curious about what we are actually made of? Not just the hair and skin and organs and stuff, but the small stuff, the atoms. How about how the food we eat becomes us? In his new book, our next guest tackles these and other ultimate questions of life, the universe, and everything. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are these things you are curious about, or were you as a kid? Do you have a question about what we're made of, what we're not made of, how we got to be what we are? Our next guest goes back to the Big Bang to start things off. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Dan Levitt writes and produces science and history documentaries. His new book is called What's Gotten Into You? The Story of Your Body's Atoms from the Big Bang Through Last Night's Dinner. Dan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much. I'm so happy to be here.
I got to ask about the journey here, because if I thought of some of the starting questions you did, I might, you know, go online for a couple few minutes and then be done with it. Instead, you literally go from Big Bang to how we, you know, how our cells turn food into energy, plus the science behind it. What kicked off this journey?
You know, it started with a question. When my teenage daughter was thinking of becoming a vegetarian, I naturally was wondering what she would have to eat in order to remain healthy. And when I started thinking about it, I actually realized I have no idea what our bodies were made of. And a little bit more thinking, and I realized I actually don't even know where that stuff, whatever it was, came from. And then it kind of hit me, which was, wow, everything that's in our bodies now, every single particle, actually started 13.8 billion years ago at the Big Bang. And so that kicked off a whole lot of Googling and questioning. And, you know, what I discovered is not just that it's an amazing journey from there to here, but also the fact that we are made of particles from the Big Bang, and we can actually reconstruct that journey and look back and figure out how we got here. That's also just amazing. So how scientists discovered it also was something that just absolutely fascinated me.
I'm gonna go to some of the things that fascinated me that I learned in your book. So you mentioned some of our material, or all of it, originated 13.8 billion years ago. The bits of us that are hydrogen, which is a fair amount of us, that's the original material. Those are the same atoms as when the universe started.
That's it. And that's 10% of your body. But all the other atoms, which are different elements like oxygen and carbon and so on, their constituents, the electrons and the protons that they're made of, also came right out of the Big Bang.
But they needed a little work, right? So those bigger atoms, the carbons and things like that, how did they end up existing in the universe, first of all, much less being part of us?
Yeah, so once the Big Bang happened, there was a huge amount of oxygen that went out in massive clouds into the expanding universe. A large collections of those condensed into stars. And once that hydrogen was at higher and higher pressures, which gravity contracted into this higher and higher pressures and temperatures, it fused helium, and that liberated energy. And that, and when it liberated energy and the star got hotter, then it was able to make heavier elements with more protons in the nucleus. Every element has an additional proton compared to the one before it on the periodic table. So as stars created heavier elements and it released more energy, that allowed the stars to make even heavier elements until the element iron, which has 40 protons in its nucleus. After that, the rest of the elements in the universe and in our body were made by the most powerful explosions in the universe, which were supernovas, the massive explosions of stars.
Okay, and that's all amazing. But then here's the really baffling thing to me. Most of me is nothing. There's gaps among the atoms, the molecules between them. There's more nothing than something in a human body.
Yeah, I really have a hard time getting my head around it as well. But if you look at an atom, like just a hydrogen atom, 99% of it is empty space. So if you took the nucleus and you blew it up so that it was the size of a tennis ball, the electrons are worrying a mile away. So there's a huge amount of empty space within our body, so much so that some of the tiniest particles that we know of, like, called neutrinos, they can just shoot right through us.
We are talking about what we're made of with author Dan Levitt. His new book is What's Gotten Into You? The Story of Your Body's Atoms from the Big Bang Through Last Night's Dinner. You can join in with your questions, your experiences in studying these things, maybe at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Hey, Jeff.
Hi. This is a good topic. It's something I've internalized. I've read recently that men, male Americans at least, part of a research study, are deficient in magnesium. And I read that the magnesium chemical or nutrient affects how our body, how the synergy of the energy affects, that magnesium affects the relationship between the atoms in our body, and the deficiency is a negative thing, and we need to eat more magnesium. Is that enough of a question?
Jeff, I got you. If you don't mind, Jeff, I'm going to take us on a detour into the 19th century, Dan, where scientists were really tackling questions of what do we need to eat? What happens if we eat these things? What happens if we don't eat these other things? Can you talk about the quest to narrow that down?
Yeah, well, that's fun because, in the 19th century, we didn't know that we do need some minerals like magnesium. And you might wonder how they ever figured it out. And one way they figured it out was they knew that our food has proteins, fats, carbohydrates in them. And so they made artificial food with those constituents and fed them to animals like laboratory rats. And they discovered that they got sick. And so by a process of deduction, they were able to figure out that, oops, you know, we need chlorine, we need magnesium, we need potassium, we need sulfur. There are certain mineral and iron we need to get from plants in addition to the other things that we already knew about.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Another component we need, and I want to go to this one because a lot of these were discovered at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, vitamins. And I want to get it. You share the story of scurvy, which I thought I knew, right? Sailors got scurvy. They didn't eat oranges. They didn't get enough vitamin C in their diet. Easy peasy. Except people figured this out and then forgot about it again and again. Can you talk about why it was so hard to connect the dots between this horrific condition that killed thousands of sailors and just eating some oranges?
Yeah, it's baffling when you look at the face of it. Scurvy is a terrible disease, and the British Navy suffered dreadfully from it. And there was a while when ship's captains knew that if they had fresh vegetables, and particularly if they had lemons or oranges, and fed them to their sailors, they wouldn't suffer from it. But I think people got very complacent about it. And the thing that was the real killer was, at the time, no one had the concept of a vitamin. A vitamin is a weird thing. You know that if you eat something, you'll get sick from it. But who would think that if you don't eat a tiny bit of something that you've never heard of, that'll also make you sick? And at the time, there... theories of disease were about were really the Greek theories of the humors, that all the diseases they thought were created by these four humors in the body that were in imbalance. And so they didn't have the concept of a vitamin. And so it took a long, long time for them, for scientists to even get that idea in their heads. And in the meantime, the millions and millions of British sailors, among many, many other people, died from it.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Michael is with us in Appleton. Michael, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So this is a bit of a tangent, and I apologize in advance. But I read a lot of Terry Pratchett's novels, and in a couple of the Discworld books, he includes a little song that, knowing Terry, I'm not sure how much of it is, you know, taken from actual old songs and how much of it is him, but it's iron enough to make a nail, lime enough to paint a wall, water enough to drown a dog, and it goes on like that for a little bit, and it's just talking about all the things that it takes to make a man, and I just thought it's kind of interesting that, you know, you go back all these hundreds, if not thousands of years, and people have you tried to figure out, like, okay, but what makes us alive?
I gotcha, Michael. Thanks a lot. You kind of break down how much of product element X it takes to make a human, as that song tried to do, Dan.
Yeah, I love that. So if you weigh 150 pounds, you have a carbon enough to make 25 pounds of charcoal. You've got enough salt in your body to fill a salt shaker. You have enough chlorine to disinfect a couple backyard swimming pools, and enough iron, your caller was exactly right, to make a 3-inch nail. And furthermore, he was right, because your body is over 50% water.
Thanks a lot for the call. We're talking to science and history documentarian Dan Levitt about his new book. It's called What's Gotten Into You? The Story of Your Body's Atoms from the Big Bang Through Last Night's Dinner. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about anything we've been talking about his journey to learn the history of the stuff we're made of, the atoms and molecules and nutrients and how they get there? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Dan Levitt about his new book. It's called What's Gotten Into You? The Story of Your Body's Atoms from the Big Bang Through Last Night's Dinner. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Dan, before we go back to our callers, a big part of your book is about the scientists who made the discoveries you're looking at and the workings of science. And an amazing theme seems to be scientists propose this idea. Everybody dismisses it as ridiculous, but then some of them say, okay, I'm going to try to disprove it. And they can't disprove it, and it becomes accepted science. What did you learn just about the way scientific progress works?
You know, I always thought that that science is just follow the evidence. But when I was researching all of these amazing discoveries, I discovered that at the time that they were first presented, so many of them, the vast preponderance of them that I looked at in my book, were just completely dismissed when they were initially presented, or the scientists treated them with complete scorn. And so I discovered that there were six particular reasons that made whole communities of scientists very skeptical of radical new discoveries, not incremental ones, but radical ones. You know, one of them, I gave them nicknames, right? One of them is the too weird to be true bias. When scientists first proposed that the universe was not static, but was expanding, I mean, huh? No way, right? I mean, it's just, it's crazy. When scientists first proposed that organic molecules, which are the molecules that our bodies are made of, which are not rock, but they are longer chains of molecules could exist in space, people were completely skeptical. And then often people had faith in the world's greatest experts and didn't always examine really carefully the assumptions that those experts made. And so, you know, I learned that these kinds of cognitive biases in the short term, not in the long term, but in the short term, can really, really retard science, because scientists, they're just not very different from any of us. We all have unconscious assumptions that often we don't bring to the fore. And when we do, sometimes we're just wrong.
Let's go back to our callers now. Chet is with us in Maquonago. Chet, hi.
Hello, it's Chet. Yeah, nice to hear from you. I'm totally relating to what you're saying about the everything you eat makes you. I teach a botany class to a bunch of fifth graders, and I'll start the day saying, first I'll say I'll show my thumbnail. So you see this thumbnail? That's a pork chop I had about a week ago, you know. But the funnest thing I like to do, and I think this relates to what you're saying, is I'd like to start the class off also with a question. I would ask them. Or tell them, I says, well, everything you eat comes from the soil. And they would often argue with me, no, what if you were raised in a cannibal family, or what about fish and all this other stuff they would ask me. But the thought that everything you eat comes from the soil it seemed kind of radical too, but it always ends up there. And then it always seems to end with us saying, well, who makes the soil for us, you know? And it's the trees, and that's how I get into the botany end of it. But the trees and the plants make soil for us, so we can grow food, so that we can make fingernails. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. Chet, thanks a lot for the call. And Dan, you spend some time on photosynthesis and the mystery of how plants convert energy from the, or it was a mystery of how plants convert energy from the sun, and that does all the things that Chet just said.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, we really are creatures of plants, and it all goes back to photosynthesis. You know, when I was in school, I probably learned about photosynthesis, but I paid it no mind. Now I think it's the most amazing reaction ever in the world. It was invented by bacteria several billion years ago. Now, it's in plants. And here's what it is. You take carbon dioxide from the air, you take hydrogen from water, and you take energy from the sun, and you make sugar out of it. And then from that sugar, you can make other organic compounds. So this is one of the many mind-blowing things that I learned in the book, is that 93% of your mass actually comes from photosynthesis. 83% of your mass was once just carbon dioxide floating in the air, and another 10% was hydrogen that was in the water. So, you know, we really are completely products in a sense of both plants and photosynthesis.
Thanks for that call, Chet. We're talking to Dan Levitt about his new book, What's Gotten Into You? The Story of Your Body's Atoms from the Big Bang through Last Night's Dinner. Staying with the mind-blowing theme, Dan, part of that process that took a while to figure out also was how cells convert stuff to energy and just the sheer rate of what's going on, the chemical reactions in a cell. Can you give us a sense of the scale, how quickly our cells are creating energy for us?
So there's an energy currency in our cells called ATP, and your average cell consumes and therefore has to remake 10 to 100 million of them every single second. And the way it does that is unbelievable. This was another incredible thing that I learned, which is it's done in a little chemical factory in your cell called a mitochondria. The mitochondria has little electric currents inside, made not of electrons, but of protons. Again, protons from the Big Bang. And those protons drive these nanomachines, these unbelievable nanomachines called ATP synthase. And why I call them machines is that they've got a rotor that spins at up to 300 revolutions per second. And then there's another piece that creates the ATP, and it's connected, interlinked to another piece that kicks the ATP off into the cell. It's a very beautiful, sophisticated machine, and it kind of looks almost waterwheelish, like something that Leonardo da Vinci would create. And that creates all of the energy in your body. Fun thing about that is, if you were to take all the mitochondria in your body that create your energy and lay them out flat, they would cover 2 basketball courts. There are that many of them.
Wow.
And they create as much energy in your body as a 100-watt light bulb.
In the book, you tackle a lot of answered questions, things that we figured out. Well, we people smarter than me figured out over the decades. What to you are a couple of the biggest still unanswered questions about what makes us what and who we are?
Well, the origin of life is a topic, is a subject that we have a lot of very good theories about, but that one, there's still a lot of unanswered questions. How exactly did the first cell form? And then the big one that I don't tackle in my book is consciousness. You know, I do talk a lot about how the molecules in our cells, 100 trillion molecules in each of our 30 trillion cells creates life. And we know a tremendous amount about that. But then how all the nerve cells in our brain create consciousness, that's still one of the biggest mysteries in science.
Having gone through this process and written this book, do you look at your food differently now?
Yes. There's a wonderful quote that one scientist said is, when I see people walking down the street, essentially I'm paraphrasing, I see plants rearranged.
Do you feel different as a human being, as a holder of these 13 billion year old atoms?
You know, I do, because you know, I learned that even the simplest cell is unbelievably complex and worthy of respect. And we are made of 30 trillion cells. You know, I mentioned that each one has 100 trillion atoms. If they were each the width, the thickness of a dollar bill, and you were to stack them up, they would go up to the moon and back like almost 30 times. So it's almost impossible for us to appreciate how truly sophisticated we are. Our cells are filled with all kinds of unbelievable sophisticated mechanisms that were built by, again, from particles that came down to Earth willy-nilly, ultimately from the Big Bang.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Dan Levitt. He's a documentarian who produces films about science and history. We talked to him about his new book. It's called What's Gotten Into You? The Story of Your Body's Atoms from the Big Bang through Last Night's Dinner. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.